Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. We are at the 27th festival of a Jewish culture festival, and this is yet another lecture devoted to Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the eternal, everlasting, and this year the main subject, the main theme of our festival. I am usually a bit afraid to discuss the subject and to present our guest who's going to speak today, because every time I want to find the right words to bring me closer to describe this person, they never fit his personality. They always fade when encountered with the person himself. But one thing is sure. I met Konstanty Gebert a long time ago. I met him in the previous century, before this festival was created, and I had this opportunity to meet him in Warsaw and the Jewish Culture Week that was before the festival in Krakow. And back then, we made friends, very good friends, and one thing became obvious, and this festival here was created, among others, because Konstanty Gebert had a great impact on me. His personality, as well as his wisdom, as well as his knowledge. So heart, wisdom, and knowledge. This is something that affected me. So if I'm to pick someone who's going to speak about holiness, I pick Konstanty Gebert. And I think he's going to tell you about holiness in such a way that you will be able to see holiness and also verify it in depth. He's going to speak about the holiness of Jerusalem, I think, but whatever he says, it's a great gift for us, ladies and gentlemen. So please applaud, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Konstanty Gebert. Every time I can hear Janusz speaking, I'm 100% sure that he started with selling fridges to Eskimos and that he was promoted. But as for holiness, we have one problem, right? We tend to speak about the holy city of Jerusalem. In the prayer after a meal, we talk about Jerusalem, or we say that Jerusalem should be reconstructed within our lifetime. We pray to God for it, but holiness, just like all other fundamental concepts in Judaism, is not defined anywhere. We know Jerusalem is holy, but we don't know what it means. We know that on the Sabbath, you are not allowed to work because it's in the Torah. But we don't quite know what work is. And a large part of the Talmud was created because people tried to deduce from different texts what work was. So now we need to find out what holiness is on the basis of all kinds of sources and what is the holiness of a place. One thing that we know about holiness is that it is a quality of God. So holy, holy, holy God. This is what we say in prayer, is God is holy. This is what we know for sure. What is more, this is the quality of God that people can take part in. And God is direct about it. Be holy just like I am. So, this impossible to imagine, this undefinable quality of God may be our quality as well, and we know it's a quality of Jerusalem. But what's interesting, no other place is described as a holy place. So, what place is a holy place? In Polish, if something is holy, then it's the Holy Scripture. We just say it. It's a phrase. In Hebrew, you don't use this phrase. You talk about the Torah, you talk about the Tanakh, but you don't talk about these as holy scriptures. But Jerusalem is a holy city. What else is holy in Judaism? Well, there is a holy organization, Habra Kadisha. So, the funeral brotherhood, they are holy because the members of this organization provide services to those who are not able to do anything in exchange, who are not able to reciprocate. And this is considered to be the highest level of assisting another person, and those who do it are holy. Of course, on the basis of that, you cannot draw the conclusion that Jerusalem is an urban version of this kind of brotherhood. But when you consider the history of Jerusalem, then you might think it is. But this holy aspect that's available to us is related to some kind of a human effort. And I think that what is useful here is comparing two mountains. Let's start with the greatest event in the history of the Jewish nation, in the history of humanity. The event that established the Jewish nation, awarded this nation its rights. What was it? Well, we all know what it was. There were 623,000 witnesses. That was the event at Mount Zion. God came down from heaven and gave us the law, made us into a nation. 623,000 people could see that, and it's difficult to imagine something that would be less holy than that. But if you apply common sense, the Mount of Zion should be a holy mount. It's not. What is more, we don't even know where it was, except for the fact that, well, it was somewhere on the peninsula, as suggested by its name, and we don't care too much about it. Imagine, ladies and gentlemen, the Jewish holy history, well, we start from this place. We are the descendants of Abraham, and Jews are called Jews from the event at the Mount of Zion. At the Mount of Zion, and this is when the Jewish nation was created, together with the descendants of Abraham, but not only the descendants of Abraham, also all other people who were there. And this might not be to the liking of all the nationalists, but it seems that such an incredible event. God has come down from heaven, and God could be heard. The Torah says that the entire nation, all the people could hear the voice. And it cannot be described, and this what happened there cannot be described using simple words. So it might seem that we should go on pilgrimages to this mount. We should write poems about it. It should be an important point of reference, but it's not. Jews moved someplace else, and the mount is not important anymore. And very few people really pay attention to the place where something like the first collective meeting of people with their creator took place. The mountain is something simple and common Christians. Christians are much more serious about it. There is a Christian monastery there at this mount, and go and visit it when you go to Israel. But Jews ignored it. Another mount is the Mount of Moriah. We all know what happened there. Abraham and Isaac went to this mount because this is where Isaac was supposed to be sacrificed. What is more, the tradition says that Isaac knew why he was walking up this mount, and he still did it. This mount, for Jews, is the heart of the universe. The Mount of Moriah is the Temple Mount. This is the mount in Jerusalem where the first temple was established, and the second temple was built, and then the third temple will be built. This is where Hamal Sharif is now. That is a complex of two mosques. This is the mount that is the heart of the universe, because Jerusalem was built around this mount. Jerusalem can be called a holy city. So, what is the fundamental difference in between Sinai and Moriah? Well, at the Mount of Sinai, God came down to meet man. But this is something obvious. I mean, God keeps talking to us all the time, and we are occupied by something else. That's why he needs to repeat it all the time. And in Yiddish, a person who was walking from house to house selling goods was called someone who was walking from house to house like a man with the Torah. So the fact that God talks to us is not mentioned. It's unimportant in terms of geography. It's not important where it was. But when humans make an effort to approach God, then the place where it happened becomes the center of the universe. So holiness, whatever it is not obtained from. This is a result of arising to a certain level. So, when we come to Israel from the diaspora, this is called an aliyah. So, moving upwards to the place where, to the place which is a holy place. Just like you go to the Bima, the synagogue, this is an aliyah. So, you move upwards. So these are the examples of what we can do in order to rise to the level of God, or closer to God, and become closer to holiness. So holiness is not something that can be given to us by God. This is why God never says, "You will be holy as myself." No, God says, "Be holy." He's not informing us. He is asking us to become holy. Jerusalem, which was built around the Mount of Moriah, is a holy city. But this is not something we learn from the five books. The five books mention Jerusalem 398 times, but never does it say it's a holy city. The word holy appears in the writs of prophets and in other less significant writs. Of course, our teachers must have been interested by this fact, and Maimonides says that the five books never identify Jerusalem as a holy city, because if nations learned that it was a holy city, then nations would conquer it and never let Jews inside. So God, together with us, conspires, together with us, hides the real nature of Jerusalem so that it is not possessed by others. This might be an interesting abstract, an interesting theological abstract, if not for the fact that in the last months, In the recent months, UNESCO has adopted a resolution on Jerusalem condemning Jews for making the city Jewish and defining the Mount as Muslim sacred places and depriving Jews of any rights to it. And any rights to claim that they had a relationship with this place. This is not anything new. Yasser Arafat, when he was negotiating at Camp David, would explain that he could not agree to any Jewish presence in Jerusalem because there were no Jews in Jerusalem. It was a myth, a Jewish myth. Maybe they had a temple someplace else, but who cares? In Jerusalem, definitely there were no Jews around.
Now, it's not just OWP or the PLO, but also the UN, or the UNESCO's UN agenda says so. So Maimoni is clearly wrong, or he was something right, but that when he said that the Torah was hiding this holiness of Jerusalem so that other nations find out about it. But Jerusalem did not start as a holy place. We know that David started building his temple only 400 years after the Israelites arrived in and conquered Canaan. Before that, Jerusalem was a Jebusite place. It was Jebusites were one of the Canaan's tribes, and according to tradition, in Midrashis, Jebusites are direct descendants of Shem, Noah's son, who was the first son, first king of Jerusalem, and in whose yeshiva Abraham studied. That's what tradition says, that Abraham went to learn with Melech Tzedek, the king of justice. Justice is not an attribute of the king, because it's a name of a place where the king is the king of. Justice is one of the names of Jerusalem. So there is tradition of Jerusalem's holiness, which dates Abraham, Isaac, and also the temple, but the holiness of Jerusalem as the city, we start speaking once David decided to set to give a home to the ark, and he built the temple, which then Solomon expanded and made greater. And this temple then became the heart of the world. And that's where God decided he would live among us. Well, it's really very weird that a God chooses an address. It's not that, that God goes to an office and says, you know, I need two bedrooms and a kitchen, you know. He lives everywhere anyway, and he owns, and he's an owner and ruler of everything. So what does it mean that God set his place, set his house in Jerusalem, and specifically in the temple, and even more precisely in the Holy of Holies? So the place where only on Yom Kippur the archpriest could enter. So this should be understood, as our tradition says, that our effort of rising up expressed practically through the intensity of the temple cult, but also through the intensity of spiritual and intellectual effort continuously made to live like the Lord wants, that this makes this place the place where God wants to live. He can live anywhere, but that he wanted to chose to live here was the proof that, or how successful we were in this Aliyah, how we were rising in Jerusalem at the time upwards. Although, to cite Rambam, Maimonides, this road to get closer to God through the temple cult was not a necessary one. I don't know if you remember when in the Torah first the temple cult is mentioned, described. We go back to Mount Sinai. It happens right after the golden idol story. I mean, Jews come to Aaron and they say, this man Moses, we don't know what happened to him. It's a miraculous story. Why don't you build us a golden calf so that we can pray to it? And Aaron, you know, he was then explaining that in a cloudy way. But he does that. He builds that calf. And Maimonides says that what happens afterwards, i.e. all those laws of the cult, of the temple cult, is God's response to our failure. God says, if you cannot be with us directly, you need a prosthesis. I will give you a prosthesis. I will give you exactly the dimensions, the compositions, and how to use it. If you can't walk normally, you will walk with crutches. And it seems to me that this is an incredible thing that we've managed to walk, run, dance with these crutches, and even rise to God so successfully that God decided to choose this place and live with us and make Jerusalem a holy place. But we did that all with crutches. I mean, sometimes occurs to me, now what if we could find a way to walk to God without these crutches, soul to soul? I mean, we don't know that the last time we tried it didn't work out too well, but maybe we've learned something since then. Because as you probably know very well, it doesn't end with two temples. There will be a third temple, which will stood where the first and the second stood when the Messiah comes as a ultimate fulfillment, confirmation of the Messiah times. And even there are people in Jerusalem who are preparing thoroughly for that. There is a temple institute where they recreated based on the scriptures and all the garb, all the instruments of the temple, so that when the temple is raised, that we can renew the cult and we can start sacrificing the pigeons and the animals. I mean, Maimonides is quite clear about this. I mean, when the third temple is rebuilt, the temple cult is going to be revived. He's not very optimistic, or somebody would say he's realistic about our ability to walk without crutches. But there is an interesting controversy between Maimonides and another great commentator, Rashi, because Maimonides sees that the third temple will be like the first two, and product of human hands. Rashi says it's not, that it's already in the heavens, ready there. It's not made by hand. It will be a perfect product of God's will, and it he is not saying anything about the temple cult, from which you could infer that it he makes it he allows this possibility that this temple cult will not be there. And you know, those of you who were in Haram al-Sharif, in these incredibly beautiful mosques, you know that there is plenty of empty space, empty room there. So I imagine that when this third temple descends from heaven, because on this matter I'm much closer to Rashi than Maimonides, it will not replace these temples, these mosques. It will just stand next to them. Nobody says that when Messiah comes, we will all become Jews. It only says that my house will be a place of prayer, house of prayer to all nations. He doesn't say that they will all convert to Judaism. So I imagine that the third temple will stand instead of the Dome of the Rock or the Al-Aqsa, but next to them, because at the end of the day, what is important is what we tell God, and not to which address we send the envelope. Of course, this is just a free interpretation of one thread of the tradition. Please don't take this as an authoritative Jewish position, because on this and many others, there isn't an authoritative Jewish position. But what about Jerusalem, I mean, and its holiness? I mean, Jerusalem became holy not just to us, but also to Christians, for obvious reasons, because this is where the most important events in the life and death of the founder of that religion occurred. It would be quite odd if Jerusalem were not holy, but from some point of view, the Christian holiness of Jerusalem looks more like the holiness of Mount Sinai, if it ever existed, than the holiness of the Mount Moriah. This is related to the fact that God sends to us our Son, as Christianity teaches, rather than with that Abraham and Isaac raised to the mount to be closer to God. So between the Jewish and Christian holiness, there were not too many conflicts. Of course, when Crusaders conquered Jerusalem, they cut all Jews, but they thought they were just like any every other Arab. They were treated like all other non-Christians, and deserve that plight. So there wasn't an express conflict between with Jews more than with Muslims. The conflict with Islam about the holiness of this place is much deeper and much more difficult to resolve, as you will definitely know. Until Jerusalem was part of the Byzantine Empire, the Jews chased away during Roman times were then tolerated, but much limited abilities of the cult, and only when the Sassanids pushed out the Byzantines from the Holy Land, they allowed the Jews to rebuild their presence. And also Jews were starting to rebuild the temple, but the Sassanids decided to support Christians rather than Jews in Jerusalem, and so Christians who became politically stronger in Jerusalem stopped the rebuilding of the temple, demolished whatever the Jews had managed to build, and they made this this place into a dump, and as Caliph Omar found what when he arrived in Jerusalem, and he was told that that the temple was there. So Caliph Omar ordered the first version of the current Dome on the Rock, this incredibly beautiful mosque. So it is there where the temple was, and the temple was where the Mount Moria was, in the place where Abraham wanted to sacrifice his son Isaac. So why was this Jerusalem important in the first place? Indeed, according to one Muslim traditions, it was very soon after Muhammad's death, and there were many interpretations of his teachings, and there were some intense conflicts about the correct version. So according to one of the interpretations, Muhammad rose to heaven on his stallion Al-Burak, who had the face of a woman and the tail of a peacock, and which stallion he had first tied to the western wall, which is the basis for staying the statement that the western wall and the entire Temple Mount are holy Muslim places. But Quran never mentions Jerusalem. In the 17th Surah says in the words of God, blessed him who rose to heaven from a remote mosque, Al-Aqsa, the mosque. Al-Aqsa means remote. So this remoteness of this mosque differentiate it from two other great mosques in Mecca and Medina, who were clearly the earliest two mosques in Islam. And then the subsequent tradition identified the remote mosque with the mosque, the Omar Mosque, and then the second mosque is known as Al-Aqsa, even though in the Muslim tradition there is a tradition that the remote mosque was located in Morocco. So Jerusalem is not exactly the place at all. So one way or another, the importance of Jerusalem in Islam, even assuming that it was the Temple Mount where Muhammad, from which Muhammad launched himself to heaven on his Al-Burak stallion, is not really a lot. I mean, Muslims pray with their face to Mecca, which means with their backs to the Temple Mount. They're told to pray in that direction. Much would suggest that the importance of Jerusalem's importance to Islam is a result of subsequent conflicts within Islam, and not to do with the Jewish problem with this with Islam, because the Muslims initially thought that Jews were an anachronism that would dissolve with time in the right belief in Allah. It was just to do with political rivalry between Mecca, Medina, and Syria, in the rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Syria. There is still a relics of that. So religious effects of that were secondary, and that's why until it was part of the Muslim world, was a relatively small provincial town of little importance. And in 19th century, travelers of the 19th century were really astonished that this was supposed to be this Jerusalem that was the center of the world. I mean, I don't know if you've ever visited the River Jordan, but really this is something like in Warsaw you would say it's a little bit of a larger River Schwieder, and in Krakow maybe Rudava, not more than that. But if there is a coach is riding to from Jordan to Israel, the rear wheels are in Jordan and the front wheels are in Israel already. So as Henry Kissinger said, that to no river PR did so much as it did to the River Jordan. So only later Jerusalem is a third holy place in Islam. So, which is it is now. I mean, regardless of what was Muslims' original importance to the Muslim world, today it is definitely the third center of this world, which is still being contested between the Hashemite dynasty in Jordan, which has the function of the guardian of the holy place in Jerusalem, and the Al Saud dynasty chased away, and it is the guardian of the holy places in Mecca and Medina. What it is important, because the fundamental negationism in part of the Muslim world to the Jewish tradition in Jerusalem is not so it's not so relevant to the Jewish, not only to the Jewish history of Jerusalem, but also to the Muslim history of Jerusalem. But there is a reason why Omar wanted to conquer Jerusalem. I mean, all of that seems to be quite important today, when the holiness of Jerusalem is brought down to the ground level, maybe to the sea level, but maybe not only Baltic Sea, but to the Dead Sea, so the lowest possible level, and is expressed in this wild and savage rivalry for every piece of land and the interpretation of this piece of land. And even though, as we said, the most intense conflict is related between Islam and Judaism, Christianity is not part of it. So maybe to compensate it, there is an almost evenly as intense a conflict within Christianity as there is between Judaism and Islam. Now, those of you who were in the Holy Sepulchre Church know how staunch the various splinters of Christianity are in guarding their parts. I mean, there is this wooden ladder hanging from one of the windows. It's not there. Okay, so there is, oh, this is new. Anyway, there was this ladder which was hanged there when the Coptic monk who was trying to clean the windowsill between two in a window next to his window, and he was chased away, so the ladder had to stay there.
So, Christian conflicts concerning who controls sanctity, in a way, reflect the conflict between Jews and Muslims, and altogether they are an expression of a certain kind of madness that is diagnosed by psychiatrists from Jerusalem. It is called the Jerusalem syndrome. So, regular people who come to Jerusalem suddenly become prophets, or suddenly they start saying they are the Messiah announced by any religious tradition, or they start calling upon those who are with them on the bus to start penance. And this syndrome was treated there psychiatric congresses where this syndrome is discussed. You remember the Stendhal syndrome when he was stunned with the beauty of Florence. And, you know, when something is too beautiful, we are not able to accept it. This is what happens in Kyoto and Japan. There are similar problems. Simply, people are not able to cope with extreme beauty and with extreme spirituality, which is a part of Jerusalem's nature. So what we want to do is to transform it into something that we know. There is this anecdote. Once upon a time, on Yom Kippur, the entire community was praying, and one member of the community brought his young son. The son was not able to cope with the tension around, and he wanted to do something that would help him deal with it. And he took out a whistle out of his pocket and he used it. His father wanted to tell him off, and Bashanov, the rabbi, said, "No, leave him. This whistle elevated those dead prayers that were present in the synagogue." So maybe those who suffer from the Jerusalem syndrome elevate all these prayers of Jerusalem. They don't help anything, but they do not really become an obstacle in this attempt to decide about the nature of holiness. Those who are supposed to watch public order have a bigger problem. When Jerusalem was united, 3 weeks ago we celebrated the 50th anniversary of unification, and the Israeli army took over the old city in Hamal Sharif. It was an emotional experience equal to what is described by the Bible only. As those who were present say, it was a very poignant experience because the Jewish quarter was burned down to the ground, and the Jordanian army had their lanterns at the mount, and Moshe Dayan, just like the Zionist establishment of Israel, was afraid of this holy mount. In Israel, what they wanted to develop was a regular secular state, progressive state, without the entire religious part. I mean, if people want to pray, they may pray, but it should not interfere with politics and with ruling the country. And definitely he did not want to provoke hundreds of Muslims using the Israeli flag. So the legal status quo at the Temple Mount was supposed to be continued. Namely, the mount, just like before the victory of Israel, would be managed by a Muslim foundation. This Muslim foundation is supervised by the Jordanian court. And they would decide what could happen at the mount and near the mount. And this status quo is still there. What does it mean? Well, first of all, at the Temple Mount, you're not able to carry out any excavations, any archaeological works, because if you were, they might prove something that is negated by Muslims, namely the Jewish history of this place. Still, at the early 21st century, there was a third mosque developed at the mount, and hundreds of tons of soil had to be stored someplace. They were stored outside Jerusalem, and now Israeli archaeologists are looking for artifacts in this soil, and all these artifacts, of course, prove the Jewish, and not only Jewish, but also Roman, Ottoman, Byzantine past of this place. Now, as for other excavations, those of you who have been to Jerusalem might have walked along the tunnel running along the western wall. The Arabs are convinced that this is not just one tunnel, but a network of tunnels, and that Jews who are just digging tunnels under the Temple Mount so that the mosques can be pulled down so that Jews can build their third temple there. There was a large article about it last week in a serious Egyptian daily, and they presented it as an obvious fact that did not require any proof. What's the most important with regard to holiness is that there was a decree made, and it was accepted by Israel. The decree made that the Temple Mount is a place of prayer for Muslims only. So, non-Muslims are not allowed to enter mosques. They are just allowed to walk around the mount and have a look at the mount, but they are not allowed to pray there. Any kind of prayer that is different from the Muslim prayer at the Temple Mount is banned. And an Israeli police, as well as the guard, must watch the situation. If there are any suspicions concerning someone who might walk up the hill with the intention of praying, they will be accompanied by a guardian, by a member of the guard, looking at their mouth. If someone starts praying, they would be stopped. They would have to pay a fine and expelled from the mount. So Ben Gurion did not want to interfere with the religious status quo of the mount, and they don't not want to provoke the other side. So now it's the other side that starts provoking. So more and more often people enter the mount and start praying, and they are expelled. Now, Maimonides decided that if we didn't know where the holy place was located, and only the most important priest was allowed to enter it, and only after purification, and all of us are impure because complete purification is impossible after the temple was destroyed. So no Jew was able to enter the Temple Mount. Now, rabbis tend to say that this opinion of Maimonides should not be binding anymore, and Jews should be allowed to pray at the Temple Mount. But still, these rabbis are in a minority. So, but as for the holiness of Jerusalem, we will continue fighting for it, and sometimes this fight is dangerous. Of course, we may decide that that Dayan's decision to pull down the flag and to remain, to maintain the status quo, was an example of ultra-secular extremism, but the chief rabbi of Israel at that time convinced Dayan to actually explode this place. That was the only opportunity from God given by God to get rid of the mosques and finally put up something valuable there. Dayan disagreed, and 2 weeks later, in 1967, Goran was traveling to Mount Sinai to celebrate a Thanksgiving mass at the Sukkot, and And I could see photographs. There was Shlomo Goren traveling with the Torah through the empty peninsula to Mount Sinai. That was conquered by the Israeli army. And my comment would be, well, listen, what kind of people are we? I mean, we've been given the Torah for the first time, and then we take it to the sender and give it away. So he wanted to celebrate the fact of receiving the Torah in a very literal way. I mean, at the very place where it was given to people. And there is something characteristic in it. And also, in my opinion, this goes against of how Judaism understands holiness. Holiness does not mean that you need to emulate God to the largest extent possible. No. Holiness about getting as close as possible to God through your own efforts, through your own hope, even when it is impossible or even when it runs contrary to what we want, just like Abraham was climbing the Mount of Moriah. And maybe this is why in Judaism we do not have holy scriptures. But one Hasidic wise man was called a holy Jew. So if there is any holiness, it's inside us as a potential, as an opportunity. And this is why God asks us to be holy, just like myself. But in Jerusalem, this request can be better heard than elsewhere in the world. Maybe because, as the Talmud says, when God created beauty, the 9/10 of it went to Jerusalem and the rest to the rest of the world. That's all from me, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for your attention.
Ja rozumiem, że mamy czas.
Understand we have time for a couple of questions, so feel free to ask them. I've never seen a larger glass in which you could serve vodka. There must be something in the city of Krakow. Well, I just have a comment on this fantastic lecture we have just heard. In my opinion, the founder of Christianity was not Jesus, because Jesus lived like a Jew and died like a Jew. I don't know what kind of Jew he was, but another Jew founded Christianity, namely St. Paul. I don't know if you agree with me. People often mistake these two, and I think we should remember about it. Well, I humbly accept this comment, but I've never considered myself a man who was educated in terms of Christianity. He knew a lot about Christianity. But if you want to discuss St. Paul, you should remember that sometimes people say that John Paul II was the first pope that entered the synagogue. But in fact, he was the second pope, because the first one was St. Peter. Hello. Hello. I would like to thank you very much for an excellent lecture. Well, not really a lecture. It was more of an impression on holiness. And I'd like to thank you for your excellent explanation of the opposites, of the contrariness related to holiness. But my question is maybe not directly related to holiness. Namely, you referred to the Moshe Dayan, to Ben Gurion, so to the left-wing tradition, to the Zionist tradition in Israel. And here's my question. This tradition, these politicians wanted to, well, tried to work out some kind of an equilibrium in the relationship with Arabs. But the tragic irony of history is that when the government of Israel was dominated by conservative Jews and Orthodox Jews, the bloodshed is smaller. What I mean here is settlements built in Palestine, expelling these people from their own land in a ruthless way. There is a book that was published in Poland. This book was written by a Palestinian lawyer, an intellectual, and an educated man. And this book is about his walks through Palestinian hills. He loved these hills. This is where he would go for walks. And for years, this area where he could walk would become smaller and smaller because he had no place to walk anymore. And this is the irony, the tragic irony of history, don't you think? When these Orthodox Jews took over power, they did not want any. They did not want any kind of an agreement with Arabs. Well, this is a separate subject, and we could spend hours discussing it. I don't think it's so simple. Zionists, we're not so very much into finding some kind of an agreement with Palestinians. This is what was more of a pretense, and Golda Meir said there was no Palestinian nation. And she considered herself Palestinian, while right wing governments were often religious, but not truly religious. For example, a politician was caught eating shrimp. And as for expelling people from their land, definitely settlements expel people from their land, and definitely settlements are built by the nation to whom this land also belongs. Well, if you want to reconcile two nations fighting for the same piece of land, well, this is something that we know it cannot end well, and we know it from this part of Europe. It might be Eastern Poland, it might be Bosnia. So I'm not very optimistic in terms of resolving the Israeli and Palestinian conflict, but this conflict has nothing to do with holiness on both sides. I have a question concerning the message from the Messiah. When the Messiah arrives, the world will be home to all nations. No, the Lord's temple will be home to all nations. Okay. But you know, if you consider what's happening in the world now, we can see borders being built, we can see the divisions are becoming more and more important. So what is the destiny of Jerusalem? In religious terms, in spiritual terms, is it supposed to be this place of reconciliation, of unification? Yes. This is how I understand this idea of this temple that should be home to all nations. This reconciliation, this unification, was supposed to be based on bringing back David's dynasty, which is understood literally or as a metaphor. So if it's a metaphor, then it means that the sovereignty of the Jewish nation is recognized. What needs to be remembered is that the Jewish vision of the Messiah is very down to earth. It's not that people stop dying after the Messiah arrives. No, they will just stop falling ill. It's not that people will stop suffering. No, they will just stop fighting. In other words, this is an idea of what a civilized human community could live like. And we don't know much about the Messiah. So, I treat the Torah as a useful text. This is a guidebook of what I need to live a decent life on earth. And if there is nothing about life after death in the Torah, it does not mean for me that there is no life after death. But it means that this is not the knowledge that I need to live a decent life on this side. And if there is not much information about the Messiah in the Torah, it means that, well, what's important is that the Messiah arrives. And we should not think too much about what it's going to be like. Which, of course, is a provocation to make us think more about what it's going to be like. So we have two opposite concepts here. One that says that the Messiah comes when he's no longer needed. When we all achieve this spiritual level that he is no longer needed, that we are able to build the world as required by the Messiah, and his coming will be the crowning of this situation. And the other concept says that the Messiah is going to arrive when we spoil the world to such an extent that we would never be able to get out of the situation, to escape the situation that we brought upon ourselves. Of course, it would be good to check which one is true or truer as a concept. But well, this is just my intuition. I don't have any, you know, sources to prove it. But I think God likes diversity, because if he did not like diversity, we would all be made of the same kind of cheese, and we would not have a problem. For whatever reason, he did not do it. If you look around, we are all different, and it's interesting. So, it's difficult for me to imagine that the times of the Messiah will mean that eventually everyone will be the same. No. Rabbi Einstein, one of the greatest rabbis, in my opinion, would say that God is a complicated entity, but not malicious. And this is the God that I believe in.
Can I make it in English?
Is sure.
Okay. Great. Well, firstly, thank you so much. It was a very insightful talk, and really food for thought. My question is about history. If we go back, we were talking about Roman times. Mm-hmm. It's a period of time in which Jerusalem has, you know, a very big importance, not just from the Roman perspective, but the Christian perspective. And then if we look at it like the major history, we sort of skip towards the Crusades. You were talking about the 19th century and the fact that for the Muslims, it was very much a provincial town. But we go back to the Crusades and we find a period of history which, you know, has a lot of interest even in today's imagination. On the one side, it seems like the Christian side was a religious war. But if we take what you were saying to us on board, from the Muslim side, was it just political? So the question is, how can we take what you said and interpret the Crusades?
To jest znakomite, bardzo złożone pytanie. Pan mówił...
This is an excellent question, and now the question is being translated into Polish by the speaker. Well, Well, with a hand on my heart, I would like to compare historical events, because whenever you do it, you are in danger of being anachronic. The world of the 11th century, of the 12th century, was so dramatically different from the world we live in that I don't think we are able to understand it better using our own criteria of today. But what we should remember is that the Crusades meant that barbarians wanted to invade a civilization that was better developed and that wanted to protect itself from those savages from Europe. And I'm not quite sure whether Christians were motivated by religion only and whether any kind of control over trading routes was unimportant. Also, I'm not convinced that Muslims were just defending the territorial status quo. And I'm not convinced that they were not going to prove the superiority of the Muslim religion over Christianity, which at that time was proven using a sword. So I think that this issue is very complicated. However, the conclusions that we can draw may be as follows. The state of Crusaders lasted 121 years, and then it fell down. And for many Arabs, this is a proof that it's enough to wait. There is a state that is there. It is developing. It has support from abroad, but they've seen it all. It's just enough to wait. And we should not trust history too much. First of all, I'd like to thank you very much for your excellent lecture. And secondly, I'd like you to develop upon one interesting aspect, namely, I can see this image of the temple in Jerusalem and the mosque next to it. And don't you think we have a contradiction here? Because there's only one God, and this is the basis of Judaism. Can you expand on that?
Nie ma tu żadnej sprzeczności.
In my deepest understanding, there is no contradiction, because there is one God, and we all pray to him. Muslims, Christians, Jews, Buddhists. For a long time, I thought the Hinduists were a classical example of pagans. Until I met Hinduists, the world of many gods is just a metaphor. In Judaism, we have this incredible advantage over Christianity and Islam that we don't consider ourselves the only true religion. We consider ourselves the only true religion of Jews, full stop. We don't have we're not convinced that we are better than our revelation is better than the revelations of other nations to themselves. I mean, the salvation is available to all on the same rules. I mean, Jews are bound by the covenants on Mount Sinai, and others have this covenant with God with Noah after the deluge, where there are seven fundamental truths that the scholars deducted from or deduced. So you don't kill, you don't steal, you don't do idolatry. You're not told to worship God, but no idols. You have to follow the law. It doesn't say that what law is, but lawlessness is forbidden. You don't do incest and other forbidden sexual practices, and you don't persecute animals, and Noah, in our understanding, committed to this. So those, if you are not a Jew, but you live by Noah's covenant, you have the same access to salvation as Jews. So it's not proper for a Jew to become a Muslim or a Christian, a Buddhist or Hinduist or whoever, but there is nothing wrong about somebody not being a Jew, is a Muslim, Christian, and so on. God is complicated, but is not vindictive, is not vicious, is not setting traps for us. You're not born in the right family. Ah, now you're going to have a good the stick. This is the kind of God I don't believe. Thank you very much.
Poczmy się na żywej konsensus.